I'd like to introduce our speaker, Joseph Sassoon, who's written a book. We have the independent bookstore here today. There are very few independent bookstores, so the Middle East Forum is always happy to support independence. We like independent thinking, independent bookstores, and this is at the Penn Book Center, 130 South 34th Street. Book is $20, I believe.
$30.
I just took a glance at it. Mr. Sassoon is a native of Iraq, of Baghdad, so I infer that his native language was Arabic. He therefore speaks and writes English more eloquently and elegantly than probably anybody in this room. He went to All Souls School. Ephraim Karsh went to King's College, and actually they know each other. It's not in his bio, but Mr. Sassoon had been in business, so he comes to academia not through the usual routes, but probably based on merit and scholarship. So that's always a happy thing to see. He is now the adjunct professor of Middle East Studies at Georgetown University, and I make that point. I'm an alum of Georgetown, and he teaches at the Foreign Policy School, which the purpose of which is to train people to go to the State Department, so gives you a little perspective, but it is an excellent school. He's a public scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a visiting fellow at All Souls College in Oxford, and I believe that he mentioned that he will be going back to England and Oxford to teach there. He's a native of Baghdad. He received his doctorate at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. He has published extensively on Iraqi history and politics and is the author of Economic Policy in Iraq, 1932 to 1950, and The Iraqi Refugees, The New Crisis in the Middle East, 2009. His background is also in political economy. Most recently, he published Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party Inside an Authoritarian Regime, an in-depth analysis of the documents and secret audio and video recordings of Saddam Hussein's regime. This is his original research, and he gives a little indication of what he did. It's phenomenal. He will discuss the innermost workings of Hussein's control system in an attempt to explain the extraordinary rise and fall of Iraq's longest reigning ruler and implications for the study of authoritarianism, both in Iraq and the Middle East. One of the points that Mr. Sassoon makes is how Saddam Hussein took complete control of the military and the entire country. And it reminded me that last night I was at a Tea Party event, and the concept of balance, the separation of balance, balance of powers is key to the American Constitution. You see here why this in the real world is so important. Mr. Sassoon, hope you all will give him a good welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob, and thank you all for coming. My book is really, as Bob mentioned, an attempt to understand the inner workings of a modern Arab state from its own meticulous records rather than journalistic or secondary sources. For the first time, we are able to delve into the functioning of a one-party Arab state in the grip of a powerful authoritarian ideology. It is the study of the party activity and modus operandi when it ruled the country between 1968 and 2003. My research relied primarily on the massive archive of government documents captured by the United States after the fall of Saddam Hussein in April 2003. These records contain the Ba'ath Party, the intelligence services, the presidential offices, the Ministry of Information, as well as the audio tapes of meeting of the Revolutionary Command Council, and altogether provide unparalleled insights into the ideology and structure of Saddam Hussein's regime. Whereas the documents reveal the decisions already made, the tapes capture the spontaneity of private discussions among the country's leaders. These fascinating records illustrate in minute detail how the different arms of the state function, how the intelligence services gathered information, recruited informers, and carried out their surveillance of society. Reports were filed by all levels of the party hierarchy and were meticulously cross-referenced. From these records and countless memos, we can build a unique picture of Saddam Hussein and his regime. I'm going to focus on three issues. Durability, why did the regime last for such a long time? And one critical aspect of it, which was the system of rewards. Discuss information gathering by leaders during crisis, such as during Saddam. Something that is really related also to current events in countries such as Syria. And finally, mention a few pointers about the fall of Saddam and sectarianism that is dominating Iraq today. There are many ways to interpret the durability of the regime. Some argue that a dictatorship could not run by one man alone, however unrestricted his power. There is a recognition that a dictatorship can flourish on wide complicity, fueled by a variety of motives from idealism to fear, makes great sense of this durability. In Iraq, the Ba'ath Party was one of the three pillars of governance, together with the military and the bureaucracy. But it was more important than the other two. This differed from the Ba'ath Party in Syria under the first Assad, where the army was far more central because of the military background of the Syrian leadership. In Iraq, Saddam Hussein deliberately weakened the military as part of his coup-proofing, and the party became the essential core of the political system, command and control of the country. The Ba'ath ideological domination of the armed forces began immediately after the party seized power on July 30, 1968, and the party machinery soon operated in all military ranks. Historically, Iraq had developed a competent civil service that managed day-to-day administration, but the party slowly but surely crept into this bureaucracy and succeeded in bending it to serve its own political ends. Remarkably, the state bureaucracy continued to function during the decades of instability, even though the senior management of every ministry fell into the hand of Ba'athists. Centralization of power was a key strategy. Party decision was centralized through a politburo called the Party Secretariat or the Regional Command. This was really, in essence, the party's board of directors. Its functions were drawn up in a clear and meticulous way, and its hierarchy was clearly outlined. The Secretariat oversaw the running of every party branch, which in turn collected and controlled information about every aspect of civil and military life throughout the country. Gathering information was formidable. The transmission of information to the leadership was often imperfect because of its sheer volume, but it was also sometimes deliberately inaccurate or embellished to hide inefficiencies or overstated promises made by the local leadership. For Iraqi citizens, negotiating the bureaucracy's hierarchical structure was a long and arduous experience. Needless to say, decision-making was cumbersome and inefficient, but at the same time it allowed Saddam Hussein to govern without having to fear that too much power would fall into the hands of rivals. Yet, the centralization of power and Saddam Hussein's dominating personality are not enough to explain the regime's durability. Its underlying strength was derived from the remarkable symbiosis that developed between the leader and the party, which kept the regime functioning in spite of several disastrous decisions that it made. Saddam Hussein was very shrewd at manipulating the rivalries between different blocks of the Ba'ath while concentrating state power in his own hands. But he realized the need for a central narrative that could unify as well as control the population. and for an apparatus to create a personality cult that would elevate him into untouchable status. Thus, failures were always blamed on others, never on the president, and this did not change until 2003. The regime's success lay also in its ability to attract large number of supporters and make them feel vested in the system. Enrollment of new recruits was a major element of Baathification, and in its recruitment policy, the party was particularly concerned to achieve a good percentage of women members, and more importantly, to overcome the aging of the party's cadre. A great deal of pressure was brought to bear on citizens to join the party, and some became members under duress, but many joined voluntarily through conviction or from a desire to benefit from being a Baathist. The documents are abound with evidence of citizens applying to join or rejoin the party. The vast majority of party affiliates, however, played a little active role because of the party rigid hierarchy. Only the top three levels of membership were effectively involved in executing policies. Active members were subjected to frequent evaluation, promotion required passing special training courses, immersion in the cultural aspects of the party, and demonstrating the potential to serve in a more senior rank. Even so, a complex web of checks and counter-checks ensured that the privileged few could not become too powerful. The number of party card holders reached about 4 million by the end of 2002. Thus, out of an estimated population of 25 million in 2002, those affiliated with the Baath Party constituted about 16.5%, a very high number indeed. But a close look shows us a fundamentally different conclusion. The upper echelons of the party represented only 14.5% of the overall affiliates and only 2.4% of the overall population of the country. And in fact, the bottom two, the sympathizers and supporters, who really were just passive affiliates, constituted almost 60% of the party. Let me turn now to an essential element of durability of the regime, and that was its system of reward and punishment. While using extreme violence and terror against its citizens, the regime created a notable parallel system of reward for its supporters, and succeeded in underscoring the necessity and importance for every individual to support it. Medals and rewards were the cornerstone for co-optation, and the Baath managed to co-opt a large number of individuals by making it advantageous both to those who became part of the organization and even to those who were outside it to continue supporting the regime. This system co-opted a large segment of the population into dependence on rewards. Tens of thousands of Iraqis were the recipients of different medals, badges, certificates, insignias during the Baath rule. The medals signified status and privileges, and the more medals accumulated, the higher the rewards. The party was meticulous in its system of awards, and the documents give us incredibly comprehensive tables that categorize the rewards to all officials, from deputies of the president to the lower echelons of employees in the different government offices, listing their position and the size and frequency of their rewards. What is remarkable was the fact that all those handouts were considered as gifts from Saddam Hussein and not from the state, thus strengthening the notion that Saddam was Iraq. Jobs, financial bonuses, and pensions were all part of the reward system, and without one of the medals or badges, it was difficult to get into the compensation structure. Even pensions for civil servants of the same rank were not equal for holders and non-holders of party insignia. Admissions to institutions of higher education, military and police colleges, were all part of the overall reward structures. In many cases, academic appointments were dependent on political affiliation. There is no doubt that the Ba'ath regime under Saddam Hussein was generous to its supporters. The carrot and stick system was clearly defined, and it was very obvious that those who sided with the regime would be looked after. In the 1990s, the impact of sanction and the economic deterioration played into the hands of Saddam Hussein as the population became more economically dependent on the regime. In addition to the rewards and punishments that were an essential element in the durability of the regime, one can find other factors. One distinctive characteristic of the regime was its flexibility. Saddam Hussein did not hesitate to change his course of action, even if it meant a complete reversal of his declared beliefs and action. He did so in regard to tribalism, religion, the status of women, and this trait was both his strength and his weakness. Saddam Hussein's role in shaping the history of Iraq over 3.5 decades was paramount. One of my chapters discusses his personality, cult, and modus operandi. Saddam Hussein's personality was very complex, and any attempt to generalize about it in one sentence is bound to fail. While he was ruthless and determined to uproot any opposition, many of those who worked with him said he was also caring and attentive. The audio tapes of the Revolutionary Council meetings and those of the leadership are truly insightful. He was in complete control of all meetings without exception. All attendees respected and feared him, and yet he was polite, rarely interrupted anyone, and if he did, would immediately apologize. There are about 1,200 hours of these tapes at the National Defense University in Washington. At the beginning of each meeting, one could immediately sense his mood, and no one dared to contradict him or say anything that might infuriate him if he were in a gloomy mood. On the other hand, he often sounded jovial, loved to tell stories and anecdotes, prompting other attendees to join in and joke or tell stories. Sometimes he would dwell on an issue in detail and then suddenly become bored and the subject was immediately changed or dropped. Saddam Hussein unquestionably viewed himself not only as the leader, but also as the father of the nation and the Ba'ath family. He was convinced that no one understood the Iraqi people as he did or knew their deep aspiration. In one of his speeches, he says that the Iraqi people waited for him 800 years. While this was true to a certain extent that he really understood how to the Iraqi people, because what he did master the art of manipulating different groups within society and ran the country as a personal fiefdom, his instinct sometimes betrayed him, as witnessed by the unexpected uprising that took place after the end of the First Gulf War. Another important ingredient for the durability of the Iraqi regime, and in fact for all other authoritarian regimes in the country, was their ability to develop an efficient mechanism of control through their security services. The survival of the party and its leadership can be largely attributed to the party ability to expand and control its security apparatus. The system was established long before 1968, but Saddam Hussein perfected its working arrangement and utilized it in ways previously unknown in Iraqi history. The security agencies were designed to overlap and were structured so as to ensure that no one agency would become strong enough to threaten the regime. The security organization's main task was to gather information through monitoring, surveillance, and by using an extensive network of informers. Given the time constraint, I'm not going to discuss this, but suffice to say that the archives contain almost 2,000 files of the most important security service, which is the Special Security Organization, and that was run from early 1990 by Saddam Hussein's second son, Qusay. Let me turn now to the issue of information gathering. One of the big issues facing authoritarian leaders is the credibility of information they gather, particularly during crisis. In Iraq, we know now that Saddam Hussein's inner circle did not disclose the truth to him about many situations and events. Intelligence reports sent to the president were altered from their originals, as no one was willing to inform the president how the situation had truly deteriorated in certain strategic areas. In Iraq, the information gathering was further exacerbated by the fact that Saddam Hussein did not appreciate any competition and was not open to opposing opinions. The price that he paid for continually pruning his generals and ministers was that they did not tell him the truth during the Kuwait invasion and the subsequent uprising in 1991, or in the period preceding the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Interestingly, after every major event, he liked to conduct seminars to analyze them. In a fascinating audio tape of a meeting that took place in 1992 to analyze the invasion and uprising, this meeting went on, and he kept asking what went wrong in Kuwait and why was there uprising. And he was not satisfied because no one was telling him any truth. And finally, his son-in-law, Hussein Kamel, who later on in 1995 ran away with his brother to Jordan with the two daughters of Saddam and then was convinced to return and was killed, was in that meeting, and he was one of the few people who actually dared to talk to Saddam openly. And after asking him three times, "Will you be upset with me if I tell you the truth?" Saddam said, "No, I never get upset. I never get upset." And we hear this conversation between the two of them. "Hussein Kamel, the truth, we have to tell you, talking about the military, they run away, most of them, except two or three. President, the honorable people really show their true colors in these situations. Hussein Kamel, we did not provide you with the true picture of the situation due to a variety of reasons, such as fear, or someone might think we're going to lose. We had many considerations why we did not tell you the truth. Take Kuwait. The morale was at the lowest level. But when the generals came to talk to you, we could not reveal it to you or inform you with the truth about our situation." And then you get this line from the president, which is his typical way of exiting awkward situation. And he asked, "Were they embarrassed or afraid?" To give him a leeway, you know, to say they were really more embarrassed. And so Hussein Kamel, to his credit, answers both. Thus, the durability of the regime can be explained by the determination of the leadership to uproot all opposition, military or civilian. Its willingness to use violence and fear to control society, its comprehensive system of rewards, its ability to recruit large number of supporters even though many were not fully active members, its ability to exploit the talent and ingenuity of many educated Iraqis in rebuilding the country, hence allowing the system to continue functioning, particularly in the 90s, and finally the shrewdness and talent of Saddam Hussein to outmaneuver his opponents and competitors and keep them in a state of flux to the last day of the regime. Let me now turn to address briefly the question of whether Saddam Hussein's regime would have collapsed without the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Obviously, this is a hypothetical question, but it is important to understand the structure and durability of the regime. While it is impossible to reach a clear answer, I think it is doubtful that the regime would have disintegrated. Domestically, Saddam Hussein was in effective control of the major enclaves of power. Within the party and the inner circle, there was no serious competition, and no one seems to have amassed enough influence to challenge him. Finally, it is important to remember that by late 2000, Iraq's economy was actually improving. Its infrastructure was more or less back to pre-First Gulf War. The other thing to keep in mind is really in the vast majority, and this is not just in Iraq, it happened in the same way in communist Europe and in the Soviet Union, the vast majority of Iraqis who were not direct victims of repression, daily life was generally more normal than the image we have of such systems. As why the system collapsed so swiftly, I think it should be remembered again that authoritarian systems like the Ba'ath emanate masterfulness and strength, but their underlying weakness it does not become apparent until after their downfall. You saw that in the collapse of leading to the Berlin Wall, and you saw it also with the regimes recently in Tunisia and Egypt. And few anticipated the collapse of the Soviet Union in such a swift manner. Sectarianism, I think I probably didn't describe, but the Ba'ath Party was really very obsessive about collecting information on every citizen. And they loved forms. And you see in these archives, there are about 11 million documents. A lot of, a high percentage of them are documents that contain files and forms by the Ba'ath. Yet, one question was never asked, and that is the sect of the applicant or the citizen. Forms tended to ask two questions, religion and nationality. So you could be a Muslim or a Kurd or Christian and Arab. And I think it's important to keep in mind that Saddam Hussein's regime defined Iraqis not as much by their religion, but by their support and loyalty to the party. And if you look at it, Kurds, Shiites, Christians were all part of the system and were involved in its operation and intelligence services until the end. And this is really very critical because Saddam, deep down, was very secular. He launched a faith campaign, but really, when you see the documents, repression and harassment of religious movements continued. And at the same time, you realize one thing. From 35 years, you have to be 120% loyal to him to survive. I'm going to stop here and take questions.
Thank you very much. I'm Efraim Karsh of the Middle East Forum. And I'm doubly pleased to have Joseph Sassoon here first, because it's an old friend and colleague going back to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem when we were both graduates. And then the second thing is that I spent some time, as some of you may know, on Saddam Hussein. I wrote his political biography about 20 years ago, so I was not so privileged to have all these documents, apart from documents that were captured in Kuwait, but showed a relatively limited aspect of the Iraqi operation. However, I met quite a few people that had inside information to Saddam. And if I may tell a small anecdote which basically coincides with the dialogue that you brought here, which for me defines Saddam, and from there I would like to ask a question. By way of researching the biography, I came upon a Jewish doctor of Egyptian origin who lives in London, has been living in London since they were expelled by Nasser in the early 50s. And he was an ENT doctor. He operated on this part of the body, and he operated on quite a lot of Arab leaders, including in Libya and including Saddam Hussein. And he operated on Saddam Hussein 1979, just after he became president. He had a bad problem of sinuses, and he fixed it. And after the meeting, they had a conversation, and Saddam's physician was translating, and Saddam asked, am I going to suffer from bad headaches again in the future? And he said, look, those that are related to the sinuses will go away, but I don't know if you have other reasons for headache. And then he noticed that all the people in the room, including the physician, began to sweat. And the physician translated, and Saddam said, look, of course I have other reasons for headache. Everyone around me wants to kill me, but I'm more clever than they are, because I know they want to kill me before they themselves know that they want to kill me, and then I get them first. And for me, this was Saddam. Basically, everything is about survival. And as a result of this, he established the system that Mr. Sasson described. Having said this, and I discussed it briefly with Mr. Sasson before the lecture, I still find it a bit odd that Saddam Hussein, that was so obsessed about self-preservation, was in a way so careless and miscalculated in 2003, because they didn't find the weapons of mass destruction, the nuclear, the biological weapons, and apparently they are destroyed, or not, but apparently they were. If this is the case, why didn't Saddam simply let the UN instructors come to Baghdad, see that there was nothing to fear, and then he would have survived, because Bush and the international coalition wouldn't have invaded. So this is something that I, for my part, don't have an answer to this day, and I would like to see what sure. you think about it.
I think that while he was very shrewd in his understanding of the inner politics, he was really, really very weak in understanding international politics, remarkably. And you see it in a consistent basis throughout the whole period. The other aspect which you find out is he was very obsessed about Iran. And that continued, by the way, literally to the last day in his prison. You see it through the interrogation of the American interrogators after he was captured. There is a book by his defense lawyer. Every day, Iran, Iran. And from 1980, he believed that Iran is going to take over Iraq, that Khomeinism is a virus that is going to take over the Iraqi youth, and everything has to be towards that. For him, the other aspect which you realize is really his pride takes over everything. And issues that are totally irrational, but for him, you know, it's a matter of stepping down and dishonoring himself were unacceptable. And so for him, he said it time and again, I'm not going to allow these inspectors to go into my houses and palaces. Who would allow anyone to walk into their houses? That's number one. Number two, I think if you look at it, he really did not believe that a full invasion is going to take place. I think what happened after 1991, he thought, look, and he used to talk about it in these meetings. I survived an attack of 34 countries that lasted a few weeks. Who has in the history survived and still in power and still recovering? And he thought that it was a lot of it is bluff. Although you hear the Jordanians were trying to tell him that it is going to happen, the Russians were telling him it's going to happen, he did not want to listen. Three, I think it's not just this one. If you look at, in my opinion, one of his biggest ways of extricating himself from the terrible situation he put himself into would have been after 9/11. He was fighting Islamic fundamentalism. In 1994, he already banned Wahhabism. And any Wahhabis was sentenced to death. 9 months before 9/11 took place, he gave an order that is written in a document that every imam in every mosque must condemn Islamic fundamentalism. Okay? It would have been so easy for him after 9/11 to send a letter, an open letter of condolences, and then contact the American government and says, look, I have been fighting those people for 7 years. I have some information. And we're also fighting the other enemy, which is Iran. So I have the same two enemies. What does he do? He does the irrational things and sends 3 days later a letter or publishes a speech that, you know, you, the American people deserve it. Total idiocy. Sorry to say that, but it counters because I think if he had done that publicly and publicly, you know, through the channels, I think that it would have been very, very difficult. And I think then later on would have told them, look, I also, by the way, don't have weapons of mass destruction. But you need, I need this because of Iran as a deterrent factor. Unfortunately, his pride sometimes, and as I said, his interpretation of international things is really weak. And there comes what I showed is in the fact that the people around him, no one would give him. It's an inner cabinet, but it's in the name. No one was willing to give him any serious advice. He comes in and he says, I think we should tell the United Nations. And sometimes you hear someone says, well, but I think, he says, no, there was no real discussion. There was never a serious effort to say, how about changing? Everyone wanted to survive and keep, you know, intact.
Exactly, but if you follow it through, so maybe they didn't tell him the truth about the state of the Iraqi nuclear program. Maybe he thought it's more advanced than it actually was.
Well, I don't think so. First of all, I think that he did get reports, let's say, from his son, who was running the SSO and the Republican Guard. Two, he also controlled the budget. I mean, in an incredible way. I mean, there was no real budget. It's he and his 3/4 aides were, you know, you take that. I don't think that to develop these weapons, you know, it would have cost nothing. There is amount of sources. You have to understand that the state of the Iraqi army, the Iraqi industry, was almost gone. In 1991, there is a draft of an intelligence report of the Air Force saying that within a year, 2 years, that our capabilities will equal zero. But they are scared to give it to him, and a report goes and tell him, we have the strongest Air Force in the Middle East.
That's what I'm arguing.
I understand. Yeah. But they were telling him about things that don't exist. It is very hard to continue. And as I mentioned to you in one of the meetings, he says, why are these people keep asking about weapons? We don't have them, right? It's very difficult to develop such a scheme without him knowing about. I mean, he really got to know a lot of things. I think also there was a delusional state in the sense, I don't believe that he really believed that he had the best air force in the Middle East, okay? But it was convenient to accept, and you become delusional about those estate and accepting them. That's my interpretation.
Okay, Bob. With
reference to weapons of destruction, can you comment on whether Saddam Hussein actually did have them and what you learned from looking at the extensive archives?
No, I don't think he had them. As I was just mentioning, I think that he... from 96, and I'm giving you if you look at people like Charles Dulfer, who wrote about this, and he was the official American looking for them, I think he's convinced that by 96 they were more or less all destroyed and nothing was left. And he accept now that Saddam played a game with him just mostly for Iran purposes as a deterrent.
There was some criticism in this country of the administration for not having kept the Ba'ath Party and some endorsed military somewhat more intact instead of more or less destroying it when we won that war, because the critics said that there would have been less divisive factions, and we see what's going on in Iraq right now. Do you have comments about?
Sure. I think it's an important question, but of course it's hypothetical because we can't prove it. I think it was a mistake because these were the two systems that were functioning. And I think that, as I showed in the pyramid, that only relatively a small number of people were active in the day-to-day activity of the party. But I'll give you a very simple, you're a doctor. I think you could be a doctor in a hospital without being a Ba'athist. But in promotion, to be, let's say, the head of your small group or the head of your department, someone is going to say, can you please fill this form and pay $5 annual fee? And people were faced with this every day in every level, as teachers, as professors, as doctors, as engineers. And sometimes it impacted your family because you could say, you know what, I don't want to be the head of the department in my hospital. I'm not signing. But that will go into a file now. And that will affect your spouse and will affect your children when they apply to university. So a lot of people said, take the $5. I will go to once every 2 months or 2 months to some lecture in a big hall and hear about the greatness of Saddam. I think the army also was a different, really, structure because it was the only functioning, and there was part of it that was a professional. By disintegrating, one of the things that happened in Iraq is the very senior people who were Ba'athists either were captured or run away. But what happened with the de-Ba'athification, in my opinion, and I looked at it in a different context, not in this book, but in a previous one, is that almost the middle and senior middle management was taken out. So suddenly in a factory or in a government office or anywhere, you had the top gone, and now the middle were taken out, and the collapse took place.
First of all, the issue of WMD, there was an individual
who was a Christian general under Saddam, like way back from 79 or something. He wrote a book, which I have somewhere, where he said that the earthquake, quote unquote, that existed in Syria in the fall of 02, which prompted a quote unquote relief caravan, actually contained the WMDs that were being brought out. So question number one is there anything that you found that would be refuting or supporting that statement from this general whose name I forget? Number one. Number two, a friend of mine wrote a book about Iran, which I helped edit. And she says that in the northeastern section of Iraq, near Kirkuk, there were known al-Qaeda camps under Saddam. So that's something that supposedly has been very well documented and would then answer the question as to why Saddam didn't do anything after 9/11. That's two. Okay. Three, and I'll stop at three. The issue of the WMDs being known or not known, and the lying or misrepresentations that did or did not occur based on tapes that we have. It was my baseline conclusion that what ended up happening is they had plans for more WMDs, but they had sort of kept them under wraps so that at the time they would probably not have found any WMDs. But then in January of 2003, the UN report, the final report from the inspectors, showed a broad discrepancy between what they knew had been extant in 01, no, in 91, and what they had documented to have destroyed in the interim. So therefore, there were supposedly leftover materiel which could have been reassembled. So that, can you comment on that?
Sure. I have never seen anything about this general, that story of the earthquake. That's news to me. A lot of people wrote things. That doesn't mean every time that someone wrote an article or a book about him, praising him or criticizing him, that it is a fact and true. And as we all know now, unfortunately, a lot of stories that were fed to this administration were incorrect. The CIA has conducted a very wide report on al-Qaeda. There was, and these are public now, the only thing that there was a meeting in Prague between a representative of an Iraqi security agency and a member of al-Qaeda. Okay, let me just tell you one thing. He was so anti-religious that the notion, there is a wonderful audio tape in where they're discussing in the cabinet how to deal with the Muslim Brothers. And he says, look, they will never accept us. Let's start from that. They will never, ever accept us. We're a secular regime. They will never allow us to show on television a belly dancer. I am not going to tell the Iraqi people that they can't watch a belly dancer on television. I'm not going to close the coffee shops everywhere because they will never agree. But I'm not going to go to war with them. So he tells the security services in the meetings, I want you to tell them we're friends, we're going to cooperate, but I want you at the same time to plant agents and get information, and when the time is right, we can capitalize on this. There was no incentive for him, none, to be in cahoots with al-Qaeda. And no one has shown anything about it. And he had the least off to do, in my opinion, of all the others, compared to other countries with 9/11. As for whether they had things left over, look, they looked for 2-3 years. They dug everywhere. This is not one little tube that you can hide it and dug it. They went and looked, and they could not find anything. So I can't really tell you anything else apart from that.
Okay.
If I may, two quick comments, follow up. I mean, this theory that certain materials were moved to Syria, I mean, you know, I know that quite senior members of the Israeli intelligence community believed in it for quite some time, and some may yet believe in it. Again, it may not be true, but...
He hated Syria and the Syrian regimes.
Yeah, for sure. But then, you know, sometimes necessity brings, you know, strange bedfellows. Secondly, about religion. I mean, you know, when Iran began putting the pressure on him already after Khomeini came to power, I mean, he became supposedly pious. I mean, even the Iraqi flag was inscribed with Allah Akbar. So, I mean,
he built the biggest mosque, he did this, he did that, there is all... But that's why I'm saying you have to distinguish, this is the first time we're seeing that while he, you know, wanted a whole Quran to be written from his own blood, and at the same time he would give to the intelligence services orders to keep an eye on... Every mosque, they wanted, in 2000, there was an idea, could they put a visitor's book at the entrance of every mosque so they can count who is going more than once a week? If anyone is going more than once a week, they wanted to put it in a special statistics in order to follow him and his family. So, yeah, I mean, he did a lot from a public point of view.
Or survival, if you go back to the thesis. He'll do, I mean, the same with Israel, you know. He was bombing Israel and then he was negotiating with them quietly. So.
With all the sectarian strife that's happening in Iraq now, would you care to speculate on what you think is going to happen?
Could you repeat the question? I couldn't hear
it. Sure. With all the sectarianism that is happening, would I care to comment on what will happen? I am unfortunately not very optimistic. I think that the current government is heading almost to become quasi-authoritarian. If you really talk to a lot of people who are working, yesterday I gave a talk here at the University of Penn, and there are people who came back from there. I mean, there is real fear. The Kurds are not happy. The Sunnis are not happy. And even within the Shias, he's getting more and more and more, so much in control. I don't think it's anywhere near what I described. You know, the security services are nowhere to be compared. But there are a lot of worrying signs. And the minute you decide, okay, the Kurds are kind of, I'm going to keep them at an arm's length, the Sunnis are out, and within the Shias, this one is not with me, therefore I don't want him. This is not a good, it does not augur well for the country in the long run. And the country is extremely wealthy. There is no doubt about it. It's sitting today with reserves of $50 billion, and especially with oil at $100. But, you know, apart from oil, nothing has been developed in the last 6-7 years. Very, very little. Unemployment is high. Education numbers might be going up, but the quality is really deteriorating. And you still have 2 million people left Iraq after 2003. That's a huge, massive brain drain, and this massive brain drain is really continuing. I was at the Hoover Institute researching some of, because that's where the archives. I met an Iraqi guy, computer science, 28, 29. There was really nothing. He was fixing computers, and then when he managed to get a visa to the U.S., he left. So this brain drain also does not augur well for the country.
Imam was so knowledgeable of the cruelty of his father-in-law. How did he ever dream to get back to Iraq and survive?
Well, a great question, but you know, this is where it is hard to understand. You have behind you a psychiatrist might answer that. The ego of these people was so huge that they believed everything. He came to Amman. He was courted by every intelligence services in the world. And then 3 months later, no one was coming to meet him, and King Hossein kind shunned him, and he was sitting in the hotel getting bored. Saddam was playing through his daughters with his mind and kept saying to his daughters, "What, I'm going to hurt the father of my grandchildren? Think about it." I mean, and then when he came back, he went to his uncle and he says, "Look, it's up to you how you deal with this dishonor. Okay, I know what I would do with my family, but I'm not going to tell you what to do." And he went. So later on, he says, "I had nothing to do with it."
I think it reminds some people of Michael Corleone, but.
One, what was Saddam's real attitude or understanding or plans vis-a-vis Israel? And number two is really off the point. The U.S. seems to have been considering engaging Iran in hostilities. They were concerned about Iran and they chose Iraq. I don't know if that's a reality or not, but that's the way it came down. I just wondered if you had any thoughts
on that. You know, on Israel, I think Ephraim said, you know, Saddam was very pragmatic. And, you know, if you look in 1983, 84, when a couple of one congressman went to Iraq, he gave the statement, "If the Palestinian problems are going to make an agreement, I'm not going to interfere." But at the same time, the issue of the issue of Israel all the time, the usual publicity, and that's similar to the religion, you know, is Israel and Zionism, and Israel and Zionism, and they are the enemy number one. But frankly, if there were ability to gain something, he couldn't care less. I mean, that's my personal opinion. I heard an intriguing story from someone who was working on King Hussein. After King Hussein signed the agreement with Israel, he sent a messenger to Saddam and told him that, "I met yesterday with Rabin, and he asked me a favor. He would like to come and see you for 24 hours. Would you meet him?" And Saddam said, "Why not?" But then, and this is really the intriguing thing, and I saw it in two other occasions, he got upset that King Hussein didn't send a very senior person to him, sent someone from the palace. And instead of dealing with the trivia from the main issue, because, you know, in 94, 95, had he really met with Rabin? Think about, again, the misunderstanding. You know, I think he could have got out of jail. He did it again. You know, when was it? After Clinton became president, a representative from the administration came and said, "Let's talk about everything and discuss." And he got very upset with his foreign secretary, says, "What is this? They're sending some very junior person from the State Department. I mean, at least he should send Secretary of State." But which, of course, was never going to happen. But that's the kind of thing. To me, I think he was very pragmatic and he couldn't care less.
I couldn't agree more. We have time for one very quick question.
I'm just trying to remember a little bit of the history. Of course, for 10 years, we supported Hussein when he was fighting Iran. And then, I guess, out of nowhere, and this is my question, Hussein decided to take over Kuwait. And if not for that, if he just would have left Kuwait alone, he'd be sitting there today happy with everything, right? I mean, was that his fatal mistake, that he didn't know Bush number one would invade him? I mean, or, you know, Gulf War? Was that
There's something else going on, I forgot.
No, I think that part of it is correct. I think that the relationship with the U.S. began to deteriorate dramatically about after Contra-Iran took place. But we just had in November, a conference 30 years on the Iran-Iraq war, and a lot of U.S. Diplomats, CIA operatives, and military people attended. And I actually was astounded by how close the relationship was between 1980 and 1984. I mean, there were senior delegates going on all the time. They would immediately meet with the top leadership and give them information. When the Contra-Iran happened, which I again found out that it was done against the advice of the CIA and the State Department, Saddam lost his confidence. Then situation continues. He thinks he has achieved victory on the war with Iran. I think Kuwait is a little bit different. I think part of it, yes, you're right, he misread again the international scene and did not believe that the U.S. and the U.K. are going to get together and get another 30 countries to join them. Number two, I think he misread also the science with regard, he felt that oil was dropping. He had that famous meeting, which was totally like this. I interviewed the interpreter who attended the meeting between Saddam and the American ambassador at the time. And, I mean, now you realize he was saying, the Kuwaitis are the bad guys. And she kept saying to him, well, you know, we hope that you can resolve all the issue peacefully. And he thought, okay, she didn't get upset when I was saying I'm going to do A and B and C. That means she accepts. And she thought that she gave him a stern warning that it's he should never even think about it. And the result was the invasion. But of course, he was also foolish because he had the chance to pull out even after the invasion and prevent the attack on him. But again, his stubbornness, which speaks volumes about what happened pre-2003, was repeated.
Well, if I can add, I cannot hold myself, because I mean, this is something that I work quite a lot. I mean, I wrote a book on it, and I was involved in about a dozen court cases relating to the Kuwait, because the Iraqis caused huge economic damage that eventually was settled in British courts during the 80s. I mean, there was a huge economic problem in Iraq after the first war, and Saddam deeply felt, and I think with great amount of justice, that, you know, if he didn't invade and take over Kuwait and plunder it and stripped it naked, he would be done. And that's what they did in a very organized way. And in fact, it reinforces your argument about the Baath, because you see that they went to Kuwait, and like a locust, really, they sent committees, military Baath, they went there, they made lists, and they took everything that they could lay their hand on. And it took time, and during this time, he couldn't make concessions. So in this respect, I think his options for withdrawal were narrower than in 2003.
Right.
I don't know if you want to say.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But he could have, after 3-4 weeks, having plundered the vast majority, he could have turned around, but he got stuck.